interstitial space, or specifically a massless scalar field interstitial space. And so last time we basically derived the two-point function. I'll just remind you how that goes. So if you take the interstitial space in conformal time, then A of eta is minus 1 over H eta, and the conformal time eta is related to the normal proper time that sometimes called cosmic time, in which the metric of de Sitter you see is exponentially expanding universe is written like that. And we can go through the normal processes. We split the field into U divided by A, and then you show that the equation of motion is of the form U k double prime is minus omega k squared U k, where omega k squared is k squared plus an effective mass. And the effective mass depends on time, which is now conformal time, in the form. So if we look at the massless case, then it's minus A double prime over A, and that goes like minus 2 over eta squared. Now, this problem was actually exactly solvable. The mode functions, which have the correct normalization, go like 1 over root 2k, where k here is just the shorthand for modulus of k. I'm not going to write in the modulus. Multiplied by 1 minus I over k eta, e to the minus I k eta. Those are the exact solutions of that mode function. And they have the property, there's two regimes. There's the small distance or high momentum regime, which is basically when k times eta is large. So what that regime is depends on time. I guess it's really minus k times eta, I should say, actually, because eta is actually negative. But what this physically corresponds to is saying modes inside the horizon. Because what this formula minus k eta is equivalent to the statement that k over A, which is really the physical momenta, divided by the Hubble constant, is much bigger than unity. Or equivalently, that the physical wavelength, which is A times the co-moving wavelength, has to be much smaller than the Hubble length, the size, which is effectively the size of the horizon. And so the picture we have in this regime, if this is supposed to represent the Sitter space, and we're here, and that's our horizon at length h minus 1, then we're looking at modes whose wavelength is smaller than this scale, so they're oscillating many times over the scale set by the horizon. And in that regime, this guy is large. We can ignore that, and then we see that clearly the modes in this regime are just WKV-like. So this then is clearly what we would call the positive energy mode. So WKV is good. Now, if you remember, the formula for the conformal time is a bit weird. As the actual cosmic time increases, this exponential gets smaller, so the conformal time gets smaller, but it's coming in from negative values. The conformal time is increasing, but the magnitude of the conformal time is actually getting smaller as cosmic time increases. And so that means this approximation gets worse and worse because eta here is getting smaller. That's equivalent to saying that the modes are getting stretched, their wavelength is getting bigger as the universe inflates, and they get stretched and stretched because of the inflation. This scale always remains the same, but the wavelength gets bigger. And eventually we get to a point where you basically only got like a single, more or less a single oscillation across, and then we say the modes. At that point, we say the modes are going outside the horizon. Although we don't mean the real event horizon, we mean the Hubble horizon, which is really just that curvature scale. But that's the terminology we use. That's right. So yeah, so I think you may have seen this before. So it's a dodgy terminology. It's not a real horizon. This thing is often called the Hubble horizon, but it's really the length scale associated with the curvature of the space-time in this picture. When we go into the static patch, then there's a real horizon, and we'll see where the horizon.
I'm looking over here. Is the cosmology for it? It's also called an event horizon, or just a horizon in the static patch?
Oh, it is. That's an event horizon. Yes, that's an honest event horizon in the patch. So the modes. So inflation stretches the modes exponentially rapidly. So WK starts out as good, but eventually it gets really bad, and you go into another regime where K eta. Mod k eta becomes much less than 1, so that's when the physical wavelength is much bigger than the inverse Hubble scale. And then the modes have a very different behavior, so just reading off from that, uk basically goes like minus I over root 2 k to the 3 halves. And in that regime, I can drop the exponential because if k eta is small, then this is e to the 0, I just say that's 1, basically. And I've dropped an overall 1 over eta. Now, the modes u are not the same as the modes, the actual original field phi, because we rescaled out the scale factor. So the positive frequency part of the original field is u over a. And a is minus 1 over h eta, so what you have here is I over root 2 k to the 3 over 2 times h. In particular, you notice that this is a constant. So the leading contribution, we've neglected the subleading terms, and we're just going in the limit when k eta becomes very small. The leading contribution to the field, the actual real scalar field, is a constant. It's a constant whose overall amplitude is set by the Hubble constant, and it scales like 1 over k to the 3 over 2 when we're written in momentum space. And then this is the fact that means when we go back to real space, well, already this tells you that basically the spectrum is scale invariant. And what we mean by that is if we take the real space propagator, the two-point function, so the expectation value in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, which is the state annihilated by the annihilation operators when I use those as my definition of positive frequency modes. So I should write that out. And so I'm writing phi is integral d3k over 2 pi cubed, 1 over a out front, and then we have these modes here. Let me just write it as uk. AK plus emission conjugate, where these U's are those guys. So with that definition, the two-point function, the correlation function in real space, it's very warm in here, isn't it? What's going on?
I'll talk to the person about the class.
Wow. So this real space correlation function, if you work it out in momentum space, it basically ends up being integral d3k over 2 pi cubed mod u k squared over a squared over a. Sorry, I should be more careful. It is uk of eta uk star of eta prime over a of eta prime e to the ik dot x minus x prime. So what's happening is that the combination u over a, when you go at very long wavelengths, which is equivalent to going to late times, because as the cosmic time increases, the conformal time gets smaller, modes go outside the horizon, this becomes better and better, and the field becomes approximately constant. So these guys here, approximately constant, independent of eta. And if you plug in the numbers, you get h squared over 2 k cubed e to the I k dot x minus x prime. And this is what we mean by scale invariance. The spectrum is scale invariant because if you have a power law that goes like 1 over k cubed and I rescale k by a multiple, then the measure changes by the same multiple. And so in some sense, there isn't a scale there. Or equivalently, we say that the amount of power, the power is really this quantity here, the amount of power is the same on all scales. So even though the power falls off at large values of the momenta, of course, at the same time, you're increasing the amount, the phase space over which you're integrating to compensate that. So we can say that mathematically, if we do k goes to lambda k, then this quantity is invariant. And that's what we mean by scale invariance. Now, that scale invariance actually comes about for the following reason. It's just tied with one of the symmetries in De Sitter space. So let's go back to the original. Oh, we can say this two ways. So let's go back to the original. The standard FRW cosmic time coordinates, there is a symmetry here that's very easy to see. If I do t goes to t plus c and x goes to e to the minus 2hc x, then the metric is invariant. And that symmetry is the symmetry that becomes the killing vector, the time-like killing vector when we go in the static patch. It's not time-like everywhere over the space, but it is in the static patch. So that symmetry corresponds to shifting time and rescaling space. Now, rescaling space like that is equivalent to rescaling momenta in the opposite way. Right? Because if you think, if I have e to the I k dot x, momenta is just defined by the Fourier transform, so I can keep this combination invariant. If I multiply x by e to the minus 2hc, then I should multiply by k by e to the plus 2hc at the same time. So what this is saying is that this symmetry here is a symmetry on De Sitter space. It's the killing vector in the static patch. And when we choose the Bunch-Davis vacuum, which is the natural vacuum on De Sitter space, this vacuum is De Sitter invariant, meaning that it's annihilated by the generators of the De Sitter group. Yep. Why is it what? Sorry, it's 1. You're right. Yeah, it's 1hc. So this vacuum is invariant under the De Sitter group, meaning that this thing here is actually only a function of the invariant distance between two points in De Sitter space. That invariant distance is easy to calculate by going back to the embedding coordinates. In the embedding coordinates, where we thought of De Sitter space as being embedded in a flat five-dimensional Minkowski space, then there's an unambiguous way to define the distance between two points. So I'm saying that this is a function of sigma x x prime, where sigma XX prime is the invariant distance between the two points as measured in the embedding space. So to draw that in a picture, if you remember what De Sitter space looked like when it was embedded in the embedding space, it looked something like this. And the statement is that there is always a natural De Sitter invariant measure of the distance between two points. If I've got two points on the surface of the hyperboloid, I can simply just calculate the distance between them in the embedding Minkowski space in the naive way that you would do, basically ignoring the curvature of the space. So for instance, between here and here, you'd effectively measure the distance like that. Yeah?
So does that translate into geodesic distance on the De Sitter space?
So a distance measured along a geodesic between those two points. That is a very good question. You know, it's plausible, but I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure about that. Maybe. So anyway, that's the natural De Sitter invariant measure of distance. And the two-point function, to say that the Bunch-Davis vacuum is annihilated by the generator of the De Sitter group is equivalent to saying that two-point function is De Sitter invariant. Just like in Minkowski space, the two-point function or the Feynman propagator is invariant under Lorentz transformation. So that's the equivalent statement. So that statement I just made is an exact statement, right? So the WKB thing is only valid at small distances. Now over here we're looking at the behavior at large distances. So when I'm writing this formula down, I'm looking at when the modes are effectively well outside the horizon. So WKB is not valid here at all. This is very much not WKB. Because if it was WKB, it'd be oscillating in time, but here we've got a constant. So it's very much not WKB valid. But that's the exact solution. You know, you can just calculate it. That's the trick. So the point is that because the two-point function isn't actually invariant under this symmetry, because this is just one of the symmetries of the De Sitter group, then we can do that transformation and see what happens. And we'd shift T, we shift X. But because this guy is not dependent on T, it's not dependent on the conformal time, therefore it's not dependent on the cosmic time either. It's not dependent on T, it's a constant. It's just a function of space. But when I shift X, I can shift K to keep this combination invariant, but under that same shift, because of this property, this combination 1 over K cubed to 3K is left invariant, and so you see that two-point function really is invariant under that transformation. And that's why the scalar invariance arises. The scalar invariance is so important in cosmology, deriving that almost scalar invariant spectrum. But it arises fundamentally because in inflation you're on a quasi-De Sitter space, and De Sitter space has this symmetry here, which, if I ignore the time dependence of, just corresponds to a scaling symmetry where I rescale space coordinates. And that's the scale invariance that's going on. So indeed it's true. So indeed it is true that the WKB is approximation is very bad in this regime. It's not valid at all. So if we worked out when we go in this regime, so the validity of the WKB amounts to requiring that omega k prime over omega squared is much less than unity, or we could simplify that relationship as saying omega k squared double prime of omega k, sorry, increase the prime somehow, omega k squared prime over omega k cubed is much less than unity. And you can see that this is clearly invalidated because in the regime of interest, omega k squared is k squared minus 2 over eta squared. But at long wavelengths, this term is negligible relative to this term. So we can drop that guy out. Omega k squared then just goes like a power law. And if we plug that in basically here, we're going to get a number of order 1. So let me do it. It's 4 over eta squared divided by 4 over eta cubed by differentiating this piece divided by minus 2 over eta squared to the 3 over 2, which is basically 4 over 2 to the 3 halves. And so that's definitely not much smaller than 1. So what happens is the modes start out in the WKB regime. You've got a well-defined notion of positive energy. They get stretched by inflation. The modes go outside the horizon, and WKB breaks down completely. At that point, you have no notion of positive and negative frequency modes whatsoever. And that always then corresponds, the breaking down of the WKB approximation is synonymous with particle creation. However, I can't really tell you how many particles we've created. And the reason is because in the cases where we did a well-defined calculation, we calculated, say, the number of particles was mod beta k squared. What we were imagining is some well-defined situation where WKB was good down here at minus infinity, and it was good at plus infinity, and you had some intermediate regime where WKB broke down. Now here it was clear what to do, because WKB was good here. We evolve up to this point, then we match onto the region where it breaks down, then in that region you basically create beta. Beta becomes non-zero and particles get created, and you come out and then you can match into the region up here, so the original positive energy mode becomes a linear superposition of the positive and negative energy modes for a given k, and then this guy determines the number of particles you created. In De Sitter space, in just pure De Sitter space, you don't have that situation. Because all that happens is time increases, as the cosmic time increases, conformal time decreases, modes get outside the horizon, but you never come back into a region where WKB becomes a good approximation again. So essentially, we've lost this region. We just have a situation where at minus infinity, WKB is always good, but at plus infinity, it breaks down. Now, this is a serious, well, whether it's a serious concern, it troubles people a lot, let me put it that way. Because one thing it means is that there is, in De Sitter space, in just pure De Sitter space, there is no notion of an S matrix. In De Sitter, no notion of an S matrix. Why is that? Because although you have a well-defined instate, to define particles, you need the WKB to be good approximation in some region. And you have WKB is good in the past. So as t goes to minus infinity, which is equivalent to eta goes to minus infinity, then the modes are inside the horizon, and WKB is good. And so you have a well-defined instate, which is what we're calling the Bunch-Davis vacuum, or equivalently, we can now create, that's the vacuum state, the Bunch-Davis vacuum, but we can create multiparticle states in the standard way by take the Bunch-Davis vacuum and you use the creation operators. So let's suppose I have nk1 particles with momentum k1, then you basically put in, you apply the creation operator nk times to create the vacuum, and then maybe you have nk2 particles with momentum k2, and you do the same thing, and so on. And this creates a state which has nk1 k1 particles and nk2 k2 particles. particles, etc. And so that's the standard construction of the multiparticle states using the creation annihilation operators. And all this you have in this region because we unambiguously know what our positive and negative energy modes are. But at late times, so cosmic time goes to plus infinity, which is equivalent to eta goes to zero, there is no notion of particles. Therefore, no notion of the out vacuum state. There's no analog of the B's, the B creation annihilation operators, that we had in a well-defined situation that we could use to define an out vacuum. That means there's no notion of an S matrix, because what is an S matrix? Nothing other than the probability amplitude to go from some particular in state to some particular out state. But if you don't know how to define your out states, you don't know how to calculate an S matrix. And this disturbs people a lot. It's not really a problem in field theory. It just means you just don't calculate S matrix elements. You calculate equal time correlation functions and things like that. That's what we actually do in cosmology. But it does become more of an issue when you start thinking about quantum gravity, because it's well known in gravity theories there's no notion of local gauge invariant observables, and the only sort of gauge invariant thing you can write down is something like an S matrix. And if there is no S matrix in De Sitter space, then you don't even know how to define your quantum theory of gravity in De Sitter space. And that creates a lot of problems that people worry about to this day. And this is one of the many reasons why the nature of De Sitter space in quantum theories of gravity is extremely poorly understood relative to cases like anti-De Sitter, which is extremely well understood. And all of that ties again with the fact that in anti-De Sitter you have time-like Killing vectors which are global, so you can define positive and negative energy states, you have supersymmetry and so on and so on. Yeah?
So, I mean, you mentioned the fact that in the last class that there's a horizon.
Yes.
In black holes, we're told that event horizons represent the quantum gravitational degree of freedom.
Yes, exactly.
It
is the same, so I'll get to that. So that goes. Let's go back to our horizon picture then. What we really mean by the event horizon in De Sitter, or more often it's called cosmological horizon. So if you remember the conformal diagram of De Sitter looks like a box. Basically, where this is one spatial coordinate, this is one time coordinate that goes from 0 to pi, 0 to pi. I think we call that u before. And imagine we're an observer just moving along a geodesic here. Then the statement was that there exists a horizon in De Sitter space, because even an observer that lives for the entire history of the universe, then that observer will never know about anything in this region of space, and similarly will never be able to influence anything in this region of space. And so you have a past event horizon and a future event horizon. And so the presence of this horizon is somehow tied to this fact that there aren't well-defined in and out states, because similarly, you know, if you're an observer and you're actually trying to do every experiment you could possibly do to figure out the fundamental theory that you want to do, well, you know, you're limited because of this horizon. There's only so much of the universe you could actually know about. And that limitation, as we discussed before, it's the same as in the Unruh effect. The accelerated observer can only see a region of space-time. And it's that gives rise to the notion of temperature. And the way to make that connection is basically just to do the map from, say, the flat slicing. Flat slicing covers this upper half region here. Sorry, that's a terrible picture. To the static slicing that covers the wedge. And the way we did that, if you remember, was something like we put this in spherical coordinates. It's a two-sphere. We then defined a new radial coordinate, which was e to the ht r, and we defined a new time, which was t is t plus, let me see what it was the integral hr over 1 minus h squared r squared dr from 0 to r. And with those choice, with those coordinate redefinitions, then we showed that the metric was actually equivalent to this guy. And here, f of r is 1 minus h squared r squared. And this is the metric that makes the Sitter space look like the Schwarzschild metric. It looks like a black hole. So it's closely analogous. This, of course, this is the same as the Schwarzschild metric, where f of r there is 1 minus 2mg over r c squared, the Schwarzschild. So this is the metric that makes the Sitter space look like Schwarzschild. But the picture is slightly different. For f to be positive in Schwarzschild, you need to be outside the horizon of the black hole, so r needs to be bigger than 2mg over c squared. But for f to be positive in the Sitter, r has to be less than h minus 1. So that's the difference with a cosmological horizon, is you're really, you know, you're surrounded by it, you're inside it, whereas in a black hole, the horizon is something that you're sitting outside of, typically. Now, in these coordinates, then we see that there is a killing vector, t goes to t plus c, leaving r invariant. That's the same killing vector that we'd written up here in the original coordinates. It's the same killing vector that makes the fluctuation scale invariant. And as with the Unruh story, basically this then fact, we can define an analog of the Rindler vacuum using that killing vector to define what we mean by positive and negative energy modes. So we can write down the scalar field equation in this coordinate system, where phi is written now as a function of capital R, t, and angles. If phi is 5r, t, and the angles, theta phi, which cover the S2. And then what we would do is we would decompose this into modes which are positive and negative energy. With some associated creation annihilation operators summed over energies, that's really going to be a continuous thing, with some associated mode functions, positive energy and negative energy. So here I'm not saying explicitly what the mode functions are. You're going to have to solve the equation to do it. But the point is, you just follow a very similar procedure of splitting into positive and negative energy based on, sorry, this is supposed to be capital T, based on using this killing vector here, the capital T killing vector, to use to define what you mean by positive and negative frequency modes. And in doing so, you'll get a set of creation annihilation operators that will be different than the original creation and annihilation operators. And so this formula is to be compared with the formula we actually derived in the other coordinate system, where the field ends up being 1 over A times, so let me write it out explicitly, so we have 1 over root 2K and then it will be minus h eta. plus the emission conjugate.
So these are the positive frequency defined as the modes which are positive frequency as you go well into the past. So when the modes are sub-Hubble scales, we use that WKB definition. Here, eta is not a killing vector, so it doesn't have quite the same level of grandeur as what you have in Minkowski space, because we're not defining it by a killing vector, we're just defining it by the WKB approximation. But nevertheless, that does give us a clear definition of what we mean by positive energy here. And here we have a killing vector, and we use that definition to figure things out. And then as before, I'll just sketch how it works in this case, because it really follows the Unruh calculation, except it's a lot harder. So we'll be here forever if we try and do it, but I'll sketch how it works. So the point is that these two formulas have to agree with each other when evaluated within the static patch. And that means that the B's must be expressible as a sum over the A's. So schematically, that means we must have some relationship like BE is some coefficient alpha E times K, AK, plus some coefficient B beta E K times A K dagger. This is precisely analogous to what we had in the Unruh case. And of course, there isn't really a one-to-one map between E and K. This statement must be made as an integral over all momenta. Now, the key point, though, is that it is something that's going to look more or less like a Bogoliubov transformation, and that beta here is more or less going to correspond to the number of particles. So mod beta squared integrated will be the number of particles. Let me write it more carefully. The number of particles seen by a static observer in De Sitter space-time. No. So this statement, this is in the static slicing. So in the static slicing, we have a killing vector. We've got even better than an in-out state. We've got a killing vector on that whole region. There's no ambiguity in the definition of particles there. But the particles as defined by a static observer, which are the ones which are created and annihilated by these guys, they are very different than the ones that correspond to the WKB modes, the ones that are WKB. And that's the key. As in the Unruh effect, this is what an observer sees. That's the observer definition of particle annihilation operator. And this is, in some sense, the true definition based on a sort of, you know, godlike observer that could see the whole space-time, and that's how they would choose.
So some of this matrix is really the godlike observer.
That's right.
So if he sort of gave up the notion of unitarity for a global unitary, maybe there could be something where it evolves from past to a static pattern.
Well, the evolution is going to be unitary, but it's just that you know, to define an S matrix, you need to go back to states which are asymptotically free, like states, and there's no switching off of the interaction. So the problem is that the switching off of the interaction is not present. But if you just work in the static patch, you have a well-defined notion of in and out states. Except the trick is you're going to be at finite temperature, so you'll be doing finite temperature quantum field theory. And the way it works out is basically very similar to before, and in fact it's really implicit in the map between the conformal time and the cosmic time t. This map, this coordinate transformation, is exactly analogous to what we had in the Unruh effect, where we did something like this. And in fact, that's all you really need. And so rather than calculating this full transformation, which is quite hard, let me just do it at one point in space. Let me simply choose the point x equals 0 so that I can ignore all the space dependence. So that's x equals 0 in the FRW slicing. In the static coordinates, x is 0 is the same, of course, as r is 0. It's the same as capital R equals 0. Now, the virtue of that is that it allows me to basically to ignore all the R dependents. Furthermore, at R equals 0, capital T is little t at that point. So this map between eta and t at that point and that point alone becomes a map between the conformal time and the time as seen by an observer in the sitter space that associated with the killing vector in the static patch.
Sorry, it's going back a little bit. Well, you said there's no well-defined power state for the sitter case.
Yes.
Could you say alternatively that if you set an out state, say that you've got the well-defined state?
No, absolutely not, no. Because, so the flat slicing is, so that statement was made exclusively in the flat slicing. Now, the flat slicing covers this region of space. Now, no matter what you do in the flat slicing, it's always true that WKB is good at minus infinity, but never good at plus infinity. Okay, so it's really that because you're looking at an expanding universe, and modes are always going outside the horizon. So if you start in the good region, they'll always eventually get stretched and go into the bad region. You can't time reverse that. The only way you can time reverse it is if you take the other region of space, which is the collapsing part of De Sitter, because I remember that the full De Sitter space is actually a collapsing universe and an expanding universe. So this part of De Sitter space that we throw away in the flat slicing, this is a collapsing universe, and here you have the time reverse of the problem. You have no notion of an in state, so you don't know how to define your vacuum initially, but you do have a well-defined out state. Okay. But as long as we're just looking at the expanding part, it's a one-way problem. It's always a problem at late times. Okay, so if we just look at this point, then the transformation becomes very similar. If I want to calculate these guys, the alphas, then basically what I want to do, I can plug this formula in here and do the Fourier transform to project onto the piece that gives me the positive energy mode as before. And so the formula is basically something like the alpha is going to be the projected part. So remember that E is manifestly positive by convention here, because that's what we're going to call a positive energy mode. So we project onto the positive energy part of the original mode function written now, where I'm going to write eta now back in terms of little t, or more precisely capital T. And so it becomes IH over K e to the H capital T E to the IK over H E to the minus H capital T. So at that point, that's what the value of alpha would be, just doing the inverse Fourier transform, basically, to project onto to that guy. And beta is similarly given by the projection onto the negative energy mode. There, of the same solution. So those formulas should be very familiar from the Unruh case. And the same trick, we're not going to evaluate those integrals. We're just going to use a trick to make them convergent. And it's the same trick as before. If you do, basically, They're not very well defined because they're wildly oscillatory integrals here, in particular. So as t goes to minus infinity, then e to the minus ht blows up. This becomes extremely oscillatory. You want to make sense of it somehow, so you do the normal thing. You deform it into the complex plane. The simplest way to do that is just to shift t by a piece that goes like minus I pi over 2h. Remember, in the Unruh case, it was the same thing. We shifted by minus I pi over 2a. And then with that shift, that makes this combination into a convergent quantity, because e to the minus ht shifts into e to the I pi over 2 e to the minus ht, which is I e to the minus ht, and therefore the exponential e to the I k over h e to the minus ht becomes something that now converges as t goes to minus infinity, because there's a minus there. That makes the integral convergent, but then at the price, you pick up a piece from here specifically, that exponential more or less cancels that exponential and is a subdominant thing, and it's this guy that is the case of interest from the exponential. So as before, e to the IET shifts under that transformation by, you pick up an I, so you pick up e to the pi over 2h e to the IET. And similarly, the negative exponential shifts the other way. Oh, sorry, yeah. I get used to not putting the integral is over. Yes, it's over capital T. That's right. Because you're projecting onto the Fourier mode of a given energy. That's what you're doing. You're projecting onto the positive energy mode or the negative energy mode. That's what we're doing. So we're just doing a Fourier. This is the thing. We're Fourier transforming with that thing to project onto the positive and the negative energy modes. And so the same story as before, it's really analogous. E alpha over beta star EK just turns out to be, after you've done these analytic continuations, turns out to be pi over 2H. Pi over H, sorry, because you get two of them. So you get a plus and a minus, and when you're dividing, they add up together. And I've lost the K. Sorry, E. E down here from the shift. So the modulus squared scales like 2 pi E over H. And then, as before, there's a normalization requirement. But basically, the integral over k of mod alpha e k squared minus mod beta e k squared ends up being a delta function, 2 pi cubed times a delta function, which is infinite, but as before, gets regulated by the volume of space. So remember, in the Unruh case, this was the length because we were working in two dimensions. And so we plug that in. That implies integral d3k over 2 pi cubed
mod beta e k squared is 1 over e to the e over k Boltzmann t minus 1, where k Boltzmann t is h over 2 pi.
And so that's it, sketched. We've only done it for one point, but of course, the Sitter space is maximally symmetric, so if you do it for one point, you've done it for every point. And we see that, indeed, the beta squared integrated over k, which should represent the number of particles per unit volume, per unit e, is given by the Planck distribution, with a specific temperature, kt is h over 2 pi, just like in the Unruh effect, where it was a over 2 pi. And that justifies the notion that De Sitter space, to an observer in De Sitter space, they really feel themselves to be at finite temperature. So what that means is that you can, in this region, you're one observer, you live for the whole age of the universe, you have a well-defined notion of positive and negative energy modes if you live in De Sitter space, but you only see this part. And you can get all the correct answers for correlation functions and calculate things as long as you remember that you're not actually in a pure state, you're in a mixed state. You're in specifically a thermal state at this temperature. So this is equivalent to the statement that if you take the Bunch-Davis vacuum and you trace out modes outside the horizon, so in these coordinate systems, in the Rindler coordinate system, that corresponds to r being bigger than h minus 1, and you perform that trace, what you get is, up to a normalization, a thermal thermal density matrix at temperature T, given by this formula, in terms of the Hamiltonian of the static patch. This guy is the Hamiltonian that is the generator of this Killing transformation. That's the quantity. And what we're doing, here we're effectively deriving that. We're not explicitly doing the trace is hard, but here we're implicitly deriving that by showing that the map between the creation and annihilation operators picks up this thermal factor. Yeah.
Does the temperature depend on the kind of particle that you're...
No, the temperature's universal.
Massive particles would feel...
That's right, yes. Yes. In fact, yeah, there would have been no problem doing this whole argument for massive particles, other than I couldn't have written you down the mode function theorem more complicated.
So how is this done? I mean, how is the argument goes?
So it's always the same, right? Because it's basically what if you look at what's going on, what counts is that map between the conformal time and the time in the killing thing being exponential, and the fact that. And it's always the same thing, that basically then you deform the integration into the complex plane and you pick up factors from here. This guy you have in every case, it doesn't matter what spin particle or what mass particle you're looking at, you're always going to be projecting onto this guy. And so after you do that shift in the imaginary time plane, you'll always pick up here a positive factor, here a negative factor, and that gives you your effect. And that goes through regardless of your spin and mass and so on. It's a universal feature of field theory in De Sitter space that we've just done for the massless scalar case just because that is the most simple. So this notion, I mean, it's really an amazing thing, actually. it's tied in with the whole fact. We don't understand anything about De Sitter space because we don't understand this temperature, right? There's some, nowadays, people understand something about black holes and why they have temperature, why they have entropy, and so on. De Sitter space is exactly the same thing. You know, it has a temperature. It has an entropy as well. I could do a simple, just the fact that you have temperature tells you that De Sitter space has a finite entropy, just as a black hole having a temperature associated with Hawking radiation tells you that it actually carries an entropy. And we can do a simple-minded calculation of that as follows. So let me think for a second about let's think about the formula relating entropy and energy. Usually you have something like T ds is the change in energy in your system. That's thermodynamics. And so what we're doing here is we're saying the temperature is basically h over 2 pi if I set k Boltzmann to 1. Now this thing here is the energy. What is the energy in the Sitter space? Well, a simple-minded way to calculate it is you take the energy density. So if you think, let's say, so how do you get to Sitter space? So you would get it by having, positive cosmological constant. And the Einstein's equations basically tell you something like 1 over 3 m Planck squared times the energy density. And m Planck squared, here I'm using the reduced Planck units, where this is a shorthand for a 1 over 8 pi g. It's a useful one because m Planck is a mass scale. So the energy should be the energy density multiplied by the volume. Now the energy density is basically rho, which is of order h squared and Planck squared, very simply. What is the volume? Well, I mean, you know, in the flat slicing, the volume of the Sitter space is infinite. But that's not what we're talking about. We're really talking about the static slicing, where we're bounded by the horizon. So in some sense, we have a finite volume in the static patch. And this is not meant very rigorously, but essentially, you know, we're surrounded by a sphere of radius h minus 1. And so the volume should scale like h minus 3. So there is an energy, in some sense, associated with the vacuum energy of the sitter sitting inside the static patch, which goes like m Planck squared over h. And notice that the smaller h is, the more that energy is. So as you go into the Minkowski limit and you make h small, that energy gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And notice that the Planck scale comes in that formula. And the Planck scale, if we'd reintroduced units of h bar and c, would scale like h bar. And so in some sense, this is a quantum mechanical effect. So now we calculate the entropy. So basically, the entropy is of order the energy over the temperature, which is now of order m Planck squared over h squared. And indeed, that is more or less the correct answer. And in fact, the actual answer follows the same rule as for black holes. So if I think about, let me go back to writing what the static coordinates are. The horizon here is located at r as h minus 1. So if I look at the area of the horizon, then the area of the horizon, so evaluate on the horizon, these guys drop out, then the area is just basically 4 pi from the solid angle integral times h minus 2. Now, you know for black holes that black holes are well known to have an entropy which is proportional to the area of their horizon. And the proportionality is in standard units, such that the entropy is 1 over 4g times the area of the horizon. So if we're just super naive and plug in this formula, what do we get? If we take the cosmological horizon now and plug it in, we get something that looks like pi over g h minus 2. And then if I remember that the Planck scale is defined as 1 over 8 pi g, then this gives me 8 pi squared m Planck squared over h squared. And that answer is precisely what we naively guessed it should scale like. And so the presence of this temperature in the sitter ties, it immediately tells you there's an entropy in the sitter, an entropy associated with this mixed state. So de Sitter space somehow, despite being a maximally symmetric space, somehow has an entropy associated with it, just like black holes do. And whilst there is some understanding of how the entropy of black hole arises from fundamental microstates, there is absolutely no understanding of how the entropy of de Sitter space arises. And that's like, this is really one of the biggest problems today, is really understanding, you know, what this entropy for de Sitter space means. But at the semi-classical level, it comes out very cleanly by direct analogy with the Unruh effect and with the black hole, with the Hawking radiation case, and so on. Okay. All right.
Is there a good way of understanding the factor one?
I mean, not really, no, right? Because there was always the argument that, you know, so Bekenstein had the argument a while back, right? Because he said, you know, Hawking's area theorems for black holes said that if you, you know, the area always increases, right? So you two black holes collide together, the area increases, and so he guessed that the entropy was basically proportional to the area. But you can't get the factor until you know what the actual temperature is. And so that's what it comes out in the black hole case. You know, and as you know, there's sophisticated ways to argue that using Euclidean quantum gravity methods and so on like that, and that comes out as a universal formula. It is not entirely obvious that the same should work for cosmological horizons. This also means that the generalized second law should get modified. Now the statement should be not just the area of black holes always increases. The total entropy really is going to include all the entropy of black holes, all the entropy of matter in the universe, plus all the entropy of cosmological horizons. And it's that total entropy that should increase if the second law is true. And this guy can be very big, because what you see is that as h becomes smaller, so as you go more to the flat space, the entropy gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So a de Sitter space that's very highly curved actually has small entropy, but a very low curvature one has very big entropy, which is, in some sense, slightly counterintuitive, because that's the limit you go back to Minkowski space, but that's the way it plays out. So in fact, this ends up being the biggest contribution to the entropy in the universe. It's the biggest contribution, yeah. It dominates over the black hole